All right, I'm Tarek. I'm an addict and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as well. It is my pleasure this morning to introduce our monthly speaker, who's a man I've gotten to spend a couple of weekends with over the years and listen to a lot of his experience through the wonderful platform of audio, recovery audio. We have very similar roots in the program, having to go back to this man named Mark Houston, God rest his soul, and other commonalities now. But I've always been touched. My heart is always deeply touched by Peter's passion for this way of life, and more specifically, his passion for the indescribable entity we call God. And I can't wait to listen to him this morning. So I'm not going to take up any more time. I give you Peter.
Thank you, man. My name is Peter, recovered alcoholic, and grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for the invite and an extra warm welcome for those all those cats under a year and counting days. It's pretty cool to see on a Sunday morning and not being locked up in jail trying to get out on a Sunday morning. So glad you guys are here. I do have a sponsor. His name is Bob Bazans out of St. Paul, Minnesota. I do have a home group. It's called Alcoholics and God in Fort Lauderdale. And I sponsor a whole bunch of guys, probably too many for my schedule, but it's hard to say no when someone knocks on your door and asks for help. So God has put me on a place of having a servant's heart and giving as much as he allows me to give, not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but just throughout the day. It's really important for me to be consistent, and I go to God for that like everything else. I can show up in AA and appear to be spiritual and wanting to give service and kind and courteous, and when I leave AA, I'm the opposite. And if I'm truly on a spiritual walk, it needs to all look the same, whether you see me in a grocery store, you see me in an AA meeting, that needs to be the same. And what I've learned the hard way, like many of my lessons over the years, is that anything I get to do is certainly not from me, but comes to me. Even when, you know, a lot of times in AA, we say, need God's help. I've said that many times, I need God's help. The reality is I don't need God's help. I just need God. It's not like God's going to give me a jump start and I can tell him I got it from here. It's just I need God, period. And my ego loves to hear words like, God, I just need a little bit of help here because it takes over. So it's a total surrender and laying things at God's feet daily and throughout the day. In June of 1988, I had been on the streets in New York for quite a while. I was homeless. I was living in an abandoned building in a very interesting area called Alphabet City back in the day. And in that part of New York, they called it Alphabet City because Avenue A, Avenue B, C, and D. And it was not a good place to be. It was a sordid spot. Folks who lived there were just low income and couldn't get out. It was old projects, and these poor folks had to deal with knuckleheads like me. You had the junkies, you had the winos, the crack scene hit, and it was a mess. And by the time God sets me free, gets me sober, 1988, I'm in the streets where I weigh 200 pounds right now. I was 130. I had hepatitis C and I'm urinating blood and I didn't bathe it or change my clothes. I had a square meal in a really long time and the streets were hot and I was petrified. And I found this building to live in. It was abandoned. It was filthy. Very few people, the winos and the crackheads and the dope fiends were kind of shuffling in and out now and again. And I was hunkering back in the hall, way back in the hallway. And I can't tell you I felt safe. But under circumstances, I felt safe, relatively safe. The police really rarely went in there. And I would get my jug and go back there and eat some pills and hopefully pass out or at least get to oblivion where I couldn't feel the pain of living. Back then, I had been, as we used to say, tore up from the floor up. But what was killing me was the emotional pain, the soul pain. that always gets our attention. It always does. The truth always finds us. Sin always finds us. And you can't get away from that. You can't drink that away. You can't drug that away when the pain is in here. The physical beatings, I bounce back from. The humiliation, degradations, I bounce back from. But when you put all that together over and over and over again, and the truth starts to show up as it did for me, and that's right in here. When a book talks about conceding to our innermost self, that's not a conclusion of the mind, because it's the innermost self. I've heard folks say the first three steps are conclusions in the mind. I couldn't disagree with that more. It's something that happens deep down in the soul. And for me in 1988, something was changing and something was incredibly painful. I can't do this anymore, except I don't know how to get out. I've sunk too far down. I've sunk too low. There's no way of ever getting out. And the idea of living a life sober was incredibly frightening to me. How do you do it day in and day out without a little something to get through the day? So there I was in 1988. And finally, God, on June 23rd, 1988, surrenders me. And I get into my seventh, pardon me, my seventh treatment center. The same one I had been to six previous times, AMA a couple of times. There was a billboard on Sunrise Highway in Long Island, New York. It said, Peter went here. I was there so many times. People thought I worked there. I was in and out all the time. I have or had just a couple of experiences walking into an AA meeting. And those few experiences, I was drunk as anything. And no one threw me out. They just threw phone numbers at me. But I had no experience of going into AA sober prior to 1988. I wasn't a guy who had time and went out again. I had no time. And so in 1988, I get back into my seven treatment center. I'm in serious trouble at this point. Knocking on death's door, like I'm sure many in this room. And there was a great part of me that I wanted a different life. I knew this life couldn't work. But as I said a moment ago, how? How do you get out from under? Now, seven treatment centers, I got just a sprinkling of what alcoholism looks like. I really don't know. After seven treatment centers, I don't have a clue who Bill and Bob is. I know nothing about the steps. They had them, the shades in the treatment center. I thought traditions were like the Dead Sea Scrolls for some other people. I mean, I don't know what to do. God gave me a desire to stop drinking in 1988, and it came through really divine intervention in the back of this hallway. I didn't even know it was the month of June, guys. I didn't even know, let alone June 23rd. I knew the year. But I begged God for mercy, and he took me from that scrap heap to a level of life, as our book said, better than the best I've ever known. I can't believe I get to live the way I do today. So I get into my seventh treatment center and I go through this horrific detox. I left the powder stuff alone a few years prior. My arms had all marks on them and holes in them. I really didn't care for it too much. But booze and Valium owned me. And so I go through this horrible detox. And after about 10, 12 days of sitting in detox, I want to walk out and get loaded again. Because the physical torment of going through detox and the noise in the head was just awful. I didn't get a chance to leave. They sent me out to Minnesota. And while I was in Minnesota, I thought I was going to go, hey, Tarek, we got a lot of noise out there. I don't know if you can pick it up or not. They sent me out to Minnesota. There we go. I was in Minnesota doing halfway housing, sober housing, and I came in contact with some folks out there who carry the message from the Big Book. I knew I was alcoholic, but I didn't know how deep it went, and let alone the solution. And it was a meeting out there called the Three Legacies Meeting, and some wonderful people were put in my path, and they show me how to live with grace and dignity, show me how to dress for the podium, and the importance of our sacred fellowship and the program in the fellowship and the ability to do service. And when you put those things together, they take my hand and put it in God's hand. It was a long way from picking up a drink in Brooklyn, New York, where I'm from. You can tell by the way I speak, I'm not from Alabama. But growing up in Brooklyn at 14 years old, having a drink on a street corner with a bunch of guys and winding up homeless, and the downward slide of that, from drinking on weekends to drinking during the week, to trying powder, to trying weed, to putting things in my arm, and it just went worse and worse and worse. And here I am at 1988 in my seventh treatment center. Now, where I'm looking to go this morning, where God's driving me here, because I wasn't sure I was going to talk about, but I'm kind of getting pulled in a direction here. In 1988, when I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm the same guy who picked up a drink at 14 years old, who the external world owned me, my mind owned me. It raced in 100 different directions with ideas, attitudes, and emotions. I'm fear-based, insecure. I don't know how to do life. I have a lot of plans and designs in this head of mine, which is the main problem. The mind is the predator. It will always be. It's a four-letter word. And, you know, we get sober, and I think about some of my early days, and I go to God to get me sober, but I'm looking for other places to keep me happy. And in order for me to see the outside world, what's around me clearly, and to be able to discern properly, I need to go inside and be with that power first. And I had it all wrong. So at 14 years old, I'm picking up a drink, and I'm just a basket case. I was a really good athlete, really good in school, but the thing that God gave me was music. I was a really gifted musician. I was the kid in my neighborhood who was going to make it out via music. I was this little protege. I think that's what you call it. And by the time I'm 28 and my life is in shambles, but I'm physically sober sitting in an AA meeting, I'm that 14-year-old kid. I'm still driven by the past, and I'm trying to live now. I still got the old voices, the regrets, the remorse, and fear of the future were the only two things the mind's capable of doing before and later on. And I'm trying to pay attention and be like some of those other folks, joyous, happy, and free, and feeling okay and traveling light. It wasn't happening. And during my first 6 months about in AA, I went on lots of sprees, because my alcoholism will pay any price tomorrow to seek comfort right now. And what does, it goes underground and resurfaces in other areas, sex sprees, food sprees, money sprees, gambling sprees. I developed this eating disorder, and I didn't want to tell anyone, because I thought eating disorder after seven treatment centers was a gender issue. I thought only women suffered from an eating disorder, not men. So I'm not going to tell anyone. And here I am binging and purging. I'm in serious trouble. So here I am physically sober. I'm still not okay. I'm afraid to walk into a meeting because of the way I looked. I was wearing my brother's clothes, but it was intimidating to be around all of those sober folks, so I'd hide up against the wall. And I feel a little relief in the meeting. I'd certainly identify with what was being shared, but when the meeting was over, I was stuck with me and tossed and turned all night. And then I get a sponsor, and we start to go through the steps, and things started to change for me. The steps out of our big book, things started to change, and people were starting to see the change in me way before I could see the change in me. And I start to develop this relationship with a God that was always present. See, my alcoholism erodes that. My alcoholism gets a life by taking mine, yeah? But what happens is when I start to put my hand in God via the steps and the sponsor in this fellowship, is my alcoholism will always be there. I'll be an alcohol. I'll have alcoholism the day I die, but it kind of goes quiet. See, one day God's going to give me my last breath, and I'd rather die with alcoholism than from alcoholism. And I'm going through the steps. I'm kind of moving along. Nice. I get a job back. I get the little AA relationship my first AA vehicle, which goes from 0 to 60 in 3 days. You know those cars. And things, I'm doing okay, and I'm getting out to speak a little bit. I'm doing lots of service. And then we talk about problems in sobriety. And it may not be just unemployment or relationship issues, but where I'm going is the problems in sobriety, the problems in the head, the mind. I see through the mind, I speak through the mind, I act through the mind, I hear through the mind. It's the filter. And yet when you see me at a meeting, I'm quoting the big book, I'm quoting traditions, I'm quoting content, I'm telling everyone what to do. But my mind still owns me. It's my God. And that mind, which gives me my thought life, creates my current reality. I'm not okay. Now I'm pretending to be spiritually fit in AA meeting because I have lots of information, but I'm lacking a transformation. And then we talk about defects to character. And I go through the steps and I see a paragraph for each. And I say, well, it can't be that important. You know, I'll work on this defect and I'll work on that aspect. And I never realize how deep those defects go. And those are the things that even though it's just a paragraph each, I can quickly Rolodex defects and just, okay, I got this one and I just won't do it today. Yet defects have friends and they have tentacles and they come back in different ways and it's starting to devour my life and my sobriety. Because I'm still going on sprees. Like we can still go on sprees with double-digit sobriety, a fear spree, a gambling spree, a shopping spree. I'm fear-based and insecure all over again. And my ego's reemerged to the point where I can't tell anyone what's going on. I was entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Maybe I'm not so ready now. I thought I humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. And I think I can make me humble and do that. And so alcoholism is marinating in the pan again, and I'm seeing through all of these defects, all the mind, rather than operating out of the soul, which is always right. And for me, the transformation or the personality change sufficient to bring about from alcoholism is starting to operate out of the soul. I need to get soul food. I'm getting lots of information. I'm going to meetings. I'm hearing lots of great speakers. I'm listening to cassette tapes. Back then we had cassette tapes. And my head is also loaded with a lot of AA information and a lot of alcoholism and defects of character. And on Monday, I'm okay. And Tuesday, I'm not so good. Outwardly, I present well, but I got a lot of chatter in the head. And I'm not feeling okay again. What am I going to do about these defects of character? And what I've learned in 6 and 7, I can't do anything other than lay them at God's feet and ask for mercy. And when we talk about defects of character, for me, I always looked at the 7 deadly sins. You know, I look at pride. Oh my God. Pride is working in my life and I don't even know what's working in my life. And pride is I put myself in God's seat. I become God. And I'm inwardly and outwardly, I know what's best for everyone. In fact, sometimes I demand you do what I say. This meeting's not rolling right. It should be this way. This speaker's not doing that. It should be that way. And oh my God, don't misquote the big book in front of me. I'll ban you from AA. And if you break a tradition, we're going to have a court hearing about you. It's all pride. I see myself as God. And sometimes I don't even realize I'm doing it. I look at anger. Anger insists I'm right. It's a roadblock to peace, to reconciliation, to understanding, to love. And I can walk around. You know, so some of those folks who sit in a meeting and go, my name is Joe, I'm an alcoholic, and God damn it, I'm grateful. You know some of those folks. You know, they're restless, you're discontented, anger. What's behind anger is fear anyway. What's behind fear is me. So I got pride working and or anger working in my life. I got gluttony going on. I'm overindulging in everything. In food, in sex, in money, I can't stop it. I'm 50 pounds overweight and I'm still overeating and I won't work out. I won't exercise. I won't take care of this body. I'm gluttonous. I'm gluttonous with money. No matter how much I get, I want more and I spend it just as fast. I haven't been to a doctor in God knows how long, but I'm eating banana splits and bonbons and pizza every night. And I'm wondering how come I can't tie my shoes without losing my breath. I'm gluttonous. I make love to the wife and I got to keep going and keep going again. I start to go to the underbelly of sex and I'm on pornography or I'm visiting, you know, other people out there because I just can't get enough. I'm gluttonous. And greed. I want more. I have two loaves of bread under my arm and I won't give you one. There's something that says with greed, if I have two shirts, one belongs to me and one belongs to the person who doesn't have one. See, the thing about defects of character, seven deadly sins, I see through them, as I said a moment ago, and because I'm seeing through them, I have bad vision, which leads to bad actions. I'm never right. I'm never in that slot. I'm never in that the world of the spirit. I'm missing, and I can feel it. I look at envy. What I'm doing, instead of counting the blessings God gives me, I'm counting all the blessings God has given you, and I'm saying, where's mine? So even though you're my best friend and you get a new car or a promotion, inwardly, I really despise you because I think I'm entitled to that. You know, when a group has an anniversary and they ask Joe, who I sponsor, to speak instead of me, I'm applauding, but inwardly, I'm really, really angry about it. I'm counting other people's blessings. Envy leads me to coveting. I'm constantly looking at what other people have rather than the gifts God has given me. And I'm in pain. I'm uncomfortable. I'm ungrateful. I look at sloth. I'm just lazy. I don't do anything. I want a job, but I don't go out. I want to get in shape, but I don't work out. You know, I want to spend attention to the kids, but watching the game is more important. I just lay around. And then I can be spiritually slothful. I'm not praying and meditating. I'm not doing step work. I really don't call my sponsor. I'd really be bothered with sponsees. It's an inconvenience. And I kind of go to meetings, sit in the back, gossiping. I'm slothful spiritually. That's a death sentence for me. And somehow I think I can control what's not controllable and I can change what I can't change. There's a great story I heard from my priest about this slothful guy who has all these ideas about how his life should be, but does nothing about it. And he's sitting on the couch day in and day out, just laying around like a lot of us did during COVID, watching Netflix reruns, you know, just laying on the couch. And his life's going nowhere. And the Lord shows up one morning and taps him on the shoulder and wakes him up. The guy is startled and hops on his knees. Says, God, what are you doing here? He says, I've been watching you. You're slothful. You're doing nothing. He says, what do you want me to do, Lord? He says, tomorrow morning, I'm going to put a big boulder outside of your doorway. I want you to get up early and push the boulder. He says, anything. Next morning, he wakes up. He opens up his door. There's the boulder. He laces up his sneaker and starts pushing the boulder. God told him, push the boulder, push the boulder. He pushes from sun up to sundown, doesn't move an inch, goes back to bed, wakes up the next morning, does it again. He does this for like 3 months, every morning, pushing the boulder. And one day Satan shows up and wakes him up and says, what are you doing? He says, well, the Lord told me to push the boulder. He's the Lord's a liar. Why are you doing this for? It's a scam the Lord's running on you. Stop it. He says, you're right. Next morning, God shows up again. He said, I thought I told you to push the boulder. He says, God, I've been pushing the boulder every day for months, pushing and pushing from sun up to sundown. It has not moved an inch. And God's reply to him is this. He said, I told you to push the boulder. I didn't tell you to move the boulder. That's my job. So what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, my job is to chop wood and carry water and leave the results to God. My sponsor has said it a million times. A doctor does the surgery, God does the healing. A farmer plants, God does the growing. What I like to call chop wood, carry water, plow the field and leave everything for God and do it all for his glory. And he'll take me where he wants to take me and put what he wants in my life and remove. God has put a cross on my back. I carry it joyfully, gentlemen. He didn't ask me to put two on my back. Lust. A lot of us know where lust takes us. dark rooms, pornography, cheating on the spouse, and doing a lot of things that we wouldn't share from a podium at an AA meeting. Because my illness has gone underground and I'm doing stuff and I can't get rid of it. And I think I can. But I need to lay this at God's feet. And I talk about lust for power, lust for property, lust for prestige in AA. I need to be the big shot in AA. I need to be the big circuit speaker in AA. I need to be the guy in AA that when I walk into my home group, the home group goes, he's here, we can start now. I need to be the self-appointed deacon, prophet, you know, guru in my group. There's a lust for power. There's only one who has all power. That's his God. May you find him now. I need to be just a spoke in a very big wheel. A lust for notoriety. If we look at the world right now, and I want to bring outside stuff in here, but if we look, everyone wants their 15 minutes of fame. Everyone's got a cause to protest for, just to get in the spotlight. It's a lust for power, for recognition. All that says is how insecure I am in here, that I'm not okay with me, because I'm not okay with God, which means I'm never okay with you or the world around me. I just need to surrender this stuff. I got pride, anger, greed, gluttony, lust, envy, sloth. If one of these things get me, starting with pride, that's the mother of all of them. It just bleeds into the rest of them. Pride gives birth to all of those things. They play off each other. And here I am in the middle of defects of character. And I think I'm humbly ready to have God remove these shortcomings, but I'm really not. I think I'm really spiritual, but I'm really not. In fact, as soon as I think I'm spiritual, I'm probably not. As soon as I think I have some humility, I probably lost it. So for me, it really encompasses a few things. And I'll say this and we can, I guess, turn it over to you guys. My day starts off with a prayer meditation. I'm up early. The 9 a.m. start didn't scare me. I've been up for hours already. I'm usually up no later than 5 a.m. And I start my day on awakening. When I was new in AA, I was like the 8:30 wake up guy. And that changed when I met my sponsor, Mark Houston, when he was alive. We changed that for me. So I'm up at 5, sometimes earlier. There's been times like just the other morning, I walk into my kitchen and the microwave, that's how I know the time, my microwave says 3:19, but I'm wide awake. It's not like I'm tired or there was problems. I'm wide awake and ready to roll. I stay up. There was a time where I try to get back to bed and try to fall asleep. Oh my God, this is crazy. It's too early. Don't go back to sleep. What has happened so many times is I stay up. And on awakening, I do prayer meditation. In fact, while I'm in bed, I'm a Catholic. I do my little thing here, and I thank God for waking me up and giving me another day. Then I come in here, I have a prayer spot in this room, and I do my prayer meditation. My meditation sometimes is 10 minutes, sometimes it's a lot longer. After I'm done with prayer meditation, I do some reading, make a cup of coffee. I like to, my time in the morning is very sacred. It sets me up. It's not that I'm going to God to command God what to do for the day, but I'm going to God to be changed in what to do for the day. And it's not about looking like I'm praying and sound like I'm praying, but I'm really petitioning and negotiating. It's about surrendering to God. I ask him to keep me sober for the day. I ask him to bless a lot of folks, and I pray for a lot of folks, and I'm out there to carry the vision of his will and some activities. I don't do any of this perfect, but I'm broken and flawed, and there was great liberation in coming to terms with how broken and flawed I am. I'm the car when it drives away, it leaves a big oil spill. I'm really okay with that. It's how he designed it, the greater need for him. But those early morning wake-ups, whether it was in prayer or meditation or going about doing some chores, God has always downloaded something, like something on my heart that changed me, that awakened me a little bit more, gave me some insight. So I stay up. I got up this morning in bed. I asked God to keep me clean and sober. I thanked him for waking me up, and I came in here early this morning, and I opened up with some prayers. I love our third-step prayer, our serenity prayer, our seventh-step prayer, and I adore our Lord. I begin praying for other people. I thank God for all the blessings he's given me. I do none of this perfect. It's really important for me to say that to you and for you to hear that. I'm not a model or an example of anything in AA. I'm just a member. And God loves it that way. I usually get off to the gym in the morning. If I can get this body off its butt and get into a chair, it's really into the gym. It's important. I'm going to be able that I take care of this body. And I come home, freshen up and do a full day's work and get to a meeting at night. Throughout the day, though, am I talking to God? Am I communing with God? What does that look like? Because these defects of character, the ego, the pride, all those things, it's not like I'm cured of that stuff. It goes dormant for a little while, but given the opportunity, it'll pounce on me quickly and slowly. So I need to have God's armor on me all day long to keep me away from this head, from this mind. The greatest predator in the world is someone's thinking mind. I don't know why we say in some of our meetings, bring the body and the mind will follow. The last thing I want showing up anywhere is my mind at any time. In fact, quite frankly, in order to, if you will, encounter God or be in his presence or experience God, my experience has been I need to be completely out of my mind. I don't meet God while I'm thinking. I don't meet God in my mind. It is not the place I want to be to. One of the questions Mark had asked me many years ago, am I praying to God or the part of me that thinks I'm God? What does that really look like? Because the longer I'm sober, the smarter my ego gets and knows every move I'm going to make. So it's really important about being grounded and centered in on this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I'm not, relationships begin to suffer. And for me, this journey in AA in life is all about relationships, starting with my relationship with God. What does that look like? Who am I praying to? What does it sound like? And my relationships in my homes, my occupations and affairs, what does that really look like? Am I willing to eat some humble pie and go to someone and clean up an old scrape? Am I willing to pray for people that I harbor bad feelings towards? Am I willing to extend an olive branch? Am I willing to tell someone how much they mean to me and I love you, male or female, without expecting an I love you back? Am I willing to extend a hand for people I know may not be too thrilled to see me, but I'm going to offer, because that's what God would do. That's what God has done for me. When I cursed him and mocked him, he still gave me mercy. And this, to me, is really carrying God's will into all my activity, his vision into all my activities. It seems to be when I do more of that, I'm out of my mind and into my soul, and those defects of character or shortcomings, same thing, whatever you like to call them, I really don't care. They don't have the power or the juice. I have a narrative in his head that's a bad movie. And given a little air to breathe, it starts to talk a lot, and none of it's good. So for me, I need to be grounded. I need to be accountable. I need to be consistent. And so far, God has given me, I think he's doing a pretty good job so far. He's kept me sober. So I'm very, very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sober member in good standing. The only thing God wants is my soul. And I've given him my soul. We kind of do that in step three. And he's given me a life. I've given him my life and he's given me purpose. I've given him my sinfulness and he gives me forgiveness. I've given him my sobriety and he's given me Alcoholics Anonymous. Over and over and over again. So my job is to chop wood and carry water. I look for the white chippers in AA, the guys just coming in, and offer myself to them. If I can do anything to help them, it's really that important to me to stay in the center, because that's where God is, in the center. His center is everywhere, circumference is nowhere. So I just need to stay in the center of AA. And, everything I have, I owe to God and AA. My sobriety, God in AA. This laptop I'm on, God in AA. The house I live in, God in AA. My relationship to my wife, God in AA. My health, God in AA. The jacket I'm wearing, the clothes I'm wearing, the watch I have on, the wedding ring I have on, God in AA. And God in AA have put a lot of wonderful men and women in my life to kind of lift me up on their shoulders. Everything, and I'm not being falsely humble. Literally everything. I came from the streets with nothing. And I have a life of purpose and direction for this. I'm way overpaid. And anyway, that's all I got, guys. Thanks for listening. Peace.
Brilliant, brilliant talk. Thank you so much, Peter. There are so many things that resonated in your talk, the first of which was this idea that we don't need God's help, that we need God. It changes the way we live our lives if we're able to embody that idea as we go into the work. And you took that a little bit further in talking about the concession to innermost self. And if the great reality is truly deep down within, that concession is connected to our acknowledgement of the great reality deep down within. And for many of us, that surrender happens in a place of emotional destruction, spiritual ignorance, as well as complete deflation of the ego, and it's thinned out. And I call that the spiritual surrender, because the first miracle that we experience, the miracle of separation, happens very quickly. But there's a second miracle that takes place over the years, and that's the return of sanity. And as our sanity returns, we wake up uncomfortably to the realization that there's another surrender that we have to walk into. And you described it so beautifully using the seven senses. You know, those are surrenders that we experience as a result of having to swallow those large chunks of truth about ourselves that has much more to do the further away we get from a drinking drug. And so I like to think about the step process as soul making. Because, you know, we have this idea of a self that's molded and shaped by our environment. We have this thing that's referred to as the spiritual heart, which I like to think of as compassion, love, patience, but then this connection to the unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind is always related to us in terms of compulsions, and it drives us in the background. But it's also the resting place, or the manifestation of a witness. There's an entity that moves through us that observes what we've got going on in this life. And that's when the big book on page 51 says the consciousness of the presence of God. You know, that's an immanent thing. It's not transcendent, beyond our understanding. So God has two attributes of being transcendent, because we can't describe or understand it truly. But it's also something we must have access to, as Mark used to say, in the pots and the pans. And that's what I'd heard in your talk, was the soul making. But the irony in it all is the soul making happens as we confront aspects of our character. And it's almost like this awareness wakes up. I see how I'm showing up. But for some of us, by the grace of God and the mercy of God, we believe for some reason that the solution to this is a deeper, more meaningful experience of the power that we call God. I loved how you talked about the second surrender of the remission that the addict and the alcoholic goes into, but then how it resurfaces in other areas, because I'll bet dollar to donut everybody on this call is going to struggle with that one at different points on the path. And then we talk about laying our defects and our aspects of character at for God. And just as Ralph says, do something with your boy. I don't know how God's going to change me, but I do know, as I struggle with these seven sins, that my only solution is to go deeper into the relationship with the higher power. And I don't know if I'm choosing that or not. It's the way I've been designed. And he talked about the car pulling away with that oil slick. I've been designed in a very similar way, but it keeps me close to God. It sits me back down at the table with God on a regular basis. And by design, it creates a need to cultivate the expectancy of God's presence in my life. Beautiful talk. Thank you so much. We've got some time here. If anybody wants to unmute, share something with Peter, ask Peter a question. You guys know we don't punch the clock here. A bunch of stuff's been dropped in the chat. So feel free to ask a question or just say thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Welcome.
Dylan.
Peter, thank you. That was, you read my mail with that pride. I got a question. So in, what are you, like 34, almost 35 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you had to sum, if you could pick one word that keeps you around, what would it be?
Passion.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Mr. Guthrie.
Peter, thank you. I needed to hear that talk more than I can convey to you. And I've never heard myself in my current situation and the way out of it described so eloquently. And you've lit a fire under me this morning, and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Mr. Guthrie. Anybody else? All right. I know we got some new friends on this call. You know, we always talk about coming all the way in and sitting all the way down. This is an opportunity, you know, to maybe ask a question that you're scared to ask, that you haven't even asked your sponsor. And Peter has a wealth of experience. So any takers? All right. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It was an absolute pleasure to have you. And I hope we get to see each other in person sooner than later.
You bet.
Okay. One announcement that I actually, let me turn this recording.